Hello, friends, and welcome to Healing the Divide. Today, I am joined by Mary Holroyd for an episode on conscious uncoupling. We are going to be exploring themes such as being in the space of relationship when things come up that are difficult, how we can approach them with grace and with skill and with reciprocal humanness to extend to one another through what oftentimes becomes a messy and turbulent exit of spaces where we've been so vulnerable and having our hearts open and hurting, and how we navigate the potential letting go of a relationship and all the stages of that journey, what it's like to feel it come up within us, what it's like to bring that to our partners, if and when we do decide to exit an intimate space. How do we do that consciously with respect and reverence for everyone involved in that decision? Sometimes it's not even just the two people in relationships. Sometimes that's even non-conventional relationships with more than one partner. Sometimes that's there's kids involved. There's so many variations of what this could look like and the far-reaching implications of those choices and what happens to those patterns, even if we leave those contexts. And what does it look like on the other side? How do we heal not just from heartbreak, but through heartbreak? What are some of the common tendencies that emerge in those spaces? This is what we get to dive into today. So I have enrolled the support of my guest today. To give you a little background on Mary, she is a licensed mental health counselor, a licensed massage therapist, personal trainer, yoga instructor, and creator of Freedom Breathwork with over 35 years of experience. She is certified as an EMDR therapist, studied heart-centered hypnotherapy, brain spotting, and was also trained by the Harner Shamanic Studies Institute, learning various inner journey practices. Her work with couples began with her trainings for encounter work with Hetty and Yumi Scheffler in 20. A love for the work sparked, and she continued to explore various methods of treatment, including Imago work and the Gottman method. In 2020, Mary was trained as a psychedelic integration coach with Vital and added spiritual integration sessions for individuals exploring plant medicine. Mary creates a powerful blend of intuition, education, and experience by combining elements of these modalities. She has developed a service that focuses on healing, teaching, learning, and lasting lifestyle change. Mary, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk about this. It's an important topic for couples and friends and all relationships.
Yeah, it's an honor to have you here with me and to be navigating what for many of us can be some of the most powerful inflection points on our human journey. It feels to me that at the heart of so much of what makes us us is the energy of love. And love not only as a verb or in the transactional sense, but as a noun in the identity sense. And in these moments when it feels like love is exchanged, and then at least starting with the seed of the potential for love to be withdrawn, is at the core of so much of our wounding, abandonment, rejection, and then the barriers that we construct around the fear of that happening again, the mitigation patterns, and then potentially living through all of that coming back up and exiting spaces. And how do we do that? How do we take what is so often the most painful part of our human journey and actually alchemize it into a powerful and purposeful experience for the growth of everybody? And so I hand that off to you in the sense of putting it in context of, let's say, a couple is in a relationship, whether married, whether not married, but in a committed partnership, and they're beginning to feel those tendrils of, I don't know that this space is for me anymore. What would you offer as the beginning guidance for someone seeking to garner support in their relationship space?
So it depends on the phase of the relationship they're in. If they're in a place of the relationship where they are considering leaving and struggling deeply, and that actually even includes friendships, and it can sometimes include family relationships. How do I make boundaries that are healthy where there are none? What do I do with this relationship that I can that no longer serves me? Or I may think it no longer serves me, but I'm actually stuck in some pattern in relationship that I haven't quite learned to identify or heal. And so I'm in this repetitive situation in a relationship where maybe I'm being abused or maybe I'm people pleasing and I'm not really happy. I've self-abandoned in some way. And in this relationship, it's just not working for me. And so the beginning of that, I think, is always going to be an introspection and a really clear look at your own position in the relationship, even if your position in the relationship is one that feels like victimhood. Even if in your relationship, you find a long-term relationship, a marriage where you're being cheated on or lied to repeatedly, you know, in those places, it's the most difficult time to really take responsibility when there's so much anger and blame and pain and projection and fighting and confusion. And, you know, the body and the brain, the mind goes through this feeling of intense loss as a trauma. And so there's so much work being done now with people in trauma, having these trauma responses and the understanding of what the brain is doing, what the heart is doing, what the physiology is doing. And it's really important to address that initially in places of relationship where you're in deep, deep emotional release and response, introspection of, you know, gathering yourself and taking a mature stance in relationships instead of maybe patterns of behavior we had with leaving previously. So even if we look at relationships in high school, in our teenage years, in that phase of life where gender identity was being formed, we look at how we were in those early relationships and what we were learning, because that was the practice. We were trying to figure out, okay, who am I? Who is this other person? Do they like me? Do they not like me? And, you know, it starts out maybe with this great attraction where you're doodling your initials on your notebook and you're all you can think about is this person, this fantasy of high school crush and the vulnerability and that sweetness of this first love. And then maybe a few months later or maybe 2 weeks later, it ends horrifically and all this pain occurs and all these immature behaviors happen. There may be, you know, stalking and gnashing of teeth, and with an inability to regulate your own emotions and your impact on others, you're learning, you're practicing. But we don't want to take those patterns into adulthood. And we often do. We often will go back into those childlike behaviors. And then the response comes from a real deep fear of abandonment. Also a deep fear of loss, this instinctual place in us where we want to defend and become safe. So our body's physiology is in reaction. And of course, we go from the frontal lobe higher thinking into that hind brain, and we start to react in ways that are survival based. So the stalking, the Instagram stalking, the telling people bad things. You know, there's just a natural tendency for us to lash out and act out. And, you know, as we age and mature, the idea is to minimize that as much as possible and to hold on to the part of us that's in observation of our behavior and our action. But when we're in the throes of that, really the first step of any breakup that is tumultuous, because not all of them are fiery, but the fiery ones tend to be the ones that can be incredibly difficult right off the bat because of the damage of this reactionary behavior. And so when we look at the first step of those emotions and addressing them and clearing the deck. And clearing the deck is a lot about emotional release, whether you're doing breath work or you're pounding or you're writing release letters or you're talking to a friend and just getting it out. But there must be this clear knowing and awareness that that is what you're doing, not ruminating or recapitulating or commiserating. As humans, we need some of that to just to be known in our pain, just to ground that I am a person in pain and I want my day in court. I want my justification. I want someone to see me and be on my side because I feel alone, especially in a breakup, because the person that was the person that you counted on to be your person is now gone. And the depth of that openness of pain is and can be immense. And so to be grounded with other people, even in your darkness and the reactionary places that aren't so pretty, it's really important to have that, a non-judgmental space to just let it all out. Now, the idea for any relationship is you don't really want to do that and stay there. You want to do that with the intention of moving through it. You know, you had said something to me earlier, you know, healing through a breakup, not healing from. And it is healing through because each step is a phase on this staircase of growing into a higher relationship with yourself and hopefully with the other person, even in the deepest throes of pain, that you could have your day in court and say, this person did this to me and they were mean to me on purpose and they did terrible things after many years of, you know, my loyalty and commitment. Those are real things. Those are real things that must be addressed. But that first layer of clearing that can be the toughest. And the sad thing is that I've seen people get stuck there for years. And I think the biggest heartbreak after a heartbreak would be that you remain stuck in that place for any amount of time. That further is an assault to your growth and your freedom. So often being left doesn't feel like freedom. It feels like a sentence. And it's always at some point, it is a freedom. It's a freedom to really face any limitations that are there about being alone and to release any of the attachments that we had about relationship, what it meant to us. What was the dream? So not just the death of a relationship, but it's the death of a dream. And I find that that's very important to remind people of. And it's very useful when they are stuck there for long periods to say, look, I understand that this was your dream, that you took your entire life energy and you married it to someone else. And now that dream of your tomorrows, your late life, your children is now gone. Even in a friendship, you know, your dream of this person for your lifetime in 10 years when you're both older or you're both having children or your this dream of this friendship dying can be equally as painful that this was one of the people. And sometimes your person, even more so, sometimes friendships can have a deep emotional connection, access than relationships. And addressing these things from the same sort of pattern or cycle of healing is really important. And that way, as we incur the pain of this or the difficulty of this, we have a system. I don't necessarily like systems, but at the same time, it gives us this place to hang our growth on, like some place to aim for. Just like any kind of grieving, it doesn't happen in order necessarily, but if we aim our ship in that direction and we start to go to sea, and as a storm comes, we navigate. But essentially knowing where we're headed and knowing the elements that we'll face is really important. And so that first experience, which when we pass that, and I'll just go over briefly what the steps are and we can talk more about each one. Once you go past that and that initial assault has passed and you're settling into, you know, what now? What now is you, you now. And you now means really coming out of the victim stance, which is part of what occurs all along in the breakup, but really looking at once that externalization of what was done is gone, or maybe even what you did, once that's gone, it comes back to letting go of any possible self-judgment. Oh, I failed. What did I do? Working through that layer of emotion, because now this vulnerability of being with self, what did I do? I hurt the person I loved. I lied. I cheated. You know, it's very easy, and I'm doing it even now, to focus only on the person who's been left. But, you know, there's two sides here, and there's less research, honestly, if any, none that I've seen. So if anybody hears this and knows about the person who left, that maybe skipped off happily into the abyss, it's like, I'm thrilled, you know. That's a very much an untapped area of exploration. how is it for this person who skipped over some of the grieving and just went to the next person without the complete bypass? You know, what occurs over time? Essentially, what we believe happens, and what I've seen happen, I'm sure many other people who've worked with couples have seen, that they create the same thing, the same pattern with another person over time. Now, this isn't 100%, because like I said, I'm not saying that it's anecdotal, it's not research-based, but essentially, because we bring ourselves with us, we bring our limitations and our, and you know, often we may even switch roles. And if we were the one that was the leaver, we are then left, because that's how our learning works. We span both sides of the lesson until we come to center and kind of figure out how to grow from there. But regardless, that next step of reclaiming yourself, whether you're the leaver or whether you're the person who's left, whether you're one ending or the one surprised, even if it was mutual, often people come together and say, you know, this just isn't working. And, you know, how do we do this? And pulling back and just reclaiming your own individuality as a single person and facing some of the beliefs about yourself being alive, being separate, doing different activities, what limitations come up. And so after you can get through all of this emotional density, then you start to see your lessons, which is why I'll repeat again, staying in that first layer of emotional density is so damaging, because it doesn't allow anything, it's externalized, so it doesn't allow anything internal to arise. It completely eliminates introspection because we're so externally focused. And so when we can go into this deep introspection and really take responsibility for our part, and taking responsibility for our part is the most challenging thing when we have been the one who's been hurt, to really look at somebody cheated on me and left, it's all their fault, and I was just wronged, and really coming back slowly and saying, okay, let's do this in a way that let's reflect back on the relationship over the years. How was it really? How did you show up or not show up? Where did you maybe miss some things that you didn't think you did? What things was your partner saying repeatedly or not saying? How were the behaviors between you? What was the environment of that relationship truly in a forensic way to really look at the truth of it? And, you know, on occasion, there are places where people say, no, that I really did nothing. This was a total surprise. Everything was wonderful. And then we go to the next phase, if that's the case, which very rarely is the case. But then we go to the next level. Well, tell me a little bit about what you've learned from your past, from your history, from your childhood, from your early days, from your family members, about what relationships are and how they are. How is it to be a man in relationships? How is it to be a woman in relationships? What paradigm did you create in this relationship that is now or became unworkable? How did your history create this? What did you repeat? Once we get to that third step of let's find the pattern, we start looking at beliefs in relationship about deserving love, about not deserving, these deeper core wounds, these deeper fractures that when we're in relationship and we have a lot of love in the relationship, love will begin to bring up the shadow that it doesn't come alone. There's not a happily ever after. There's a happily along the way. And there's an angry along the way, and there's a sad along the way, and there's a dejected along the way. And finding a place for all of that in relationship and understanding what it means to commit in the first place and what the mechanics are of a relationship, those things really come to the forefront in that third phase of finding the pattern and looking more deeply. And wow, that's when we start to see ourselves fully. Our partner, regardless of whether we're with them at the time or we're complete with them, even friendships, this part is the deeper revelation of how am I really creating my world? And now as an individual, how do I want to create this differently? And how do I want to be different, become the person in the relationship that I want to become and draw the person that I want to be with through shifting some of the limitations that I've been taught? And that's where each step of this gets deeper and deeper. So, you know, when you think about, we start at surface of the emotional reaction, we're at the top of this, we clear the deck. And then we try to go, okay, now I clear the deck. Now it's just me and my pain, and I feel like a victim, or I'm angry still, but I'm confused. I'm on this place of, I still want to go external, but I really have to take responsibility. So we get that one step deeper, releasing the victim mentality and maybe some self-judgment. And then we go even deeper. Now let's find the pattern. You know, we take the responsibility. I didn't show up. Well, maybe I wasn't there very much. And I mean, okay, well, let's look at that. Where did that pattern come from? Let's go a little deeper. You know, the next step is really reassessing after we've gone to these deep patterns and we're doing this work, as we look at ourselves and our partner, because they come with their own pattern. They have their own thing they brought in, and we're just projecting, we're mirroring each other, but it feels very personal. It feels like this is about you did this to me, I did this to you. And it's not the case. It's these two subjective realities existing together that are not going well because they're coming from our projection. And so as we tease out this unconscious pattern and how they bang into each other and we are disconnected, we have to reassess through empathy and compassion, but especially empathy. We have to come to a place of empathy for our partner. Now, this is why I say, too, this is not always linear, because you can go back to that first stage and need to clear the deck while you're in 2 and 3. It doesn't always go away. You might go back to 1 as you're in this step 2 of trying to take responsibility, still being angry. Step 3, finding the pattern, but still having to work with these other emotions of sadness. It's this amalgam of experience, right? It's not so. It'd be great if we could just go phase 1 and then you're finished, but it's not. It would be so wonderful. Yeah, we can just time it out, but it doesn't work that way. But so this phase 4, which is really kind of reassessing your relationship with the person, even if they're not there, reassessing your perspective and saying, what was it like for them to be with me? What was it like for them in their lives? You know, what did they come in with? And when you do that, it seems to be less of a surprise. I mean, I recently worked with someone who was very angry at their spouse, and they've been divorced since 2010. He's still very much stuck in this intense, intense anger. And his former wife, it was quite clear to me that she had some pretty severe psychological problems and abuse, and was brought up in a cult. And so after she left, you know, he had talked about how terrible the relationship was and how horrible it was. But then he also talked about how angry he was that she left. And he was just, it's been stuck there for a long time. And, you know, he was able to work around to realize this is a person who was brought up in a cult, who had no sense of self, who had no real empowerment. And when she had the opportunity in her teens, she left, and she had to leave out of survival. And admittedly, that relationship was one that was so destructive by both of them, she had to leave. And he started to begin the journey to the other side of imagining her true experience based on what she said, really believing it instead of taking it personally and attacking her back. He finally has been able to really put himself there and be literally, you know, figuratively and literally in her shoes, saying, how can I imagine waking up each day with myself when I was drinking too much, when I was abusive, when I was, coming back from combat, you know, really intense pieces that he took responsibility, but he could not feel the impact until we would do deeper inner processes and actually be there. Go there, take time to close your eyes, go into your body and be your partner, living with you, be your spouse, be your friend, experiencing you. And that is humbling and sometimes crushing, and also can sometimes be rewarding. Like, wow, okay, these are the things that I actually did well, but whew, the reality sets into the body when we can really deeply immerse in empathy. And regardless of whether I work with couples that are together, they're breaking up, it is an exercise in empathy and self-awareness that brings us into any relationship that will have a long-lasting future. That empathy is the key to be with that person and go, wow, how did that hit them? And it wasn't my most shining moment. And in that heartfelt space, that's that creates something completely different, even after all that damage. So then the final phase would be really true forgiveness for self and partner. And sometimes we don't get there. That can take people a lifetime. And sometimes not. The empathy is a tremendous bridge into true forgiveness. You know, the very foundation of forgiveness is true empathy. We can't get there without it, I don't believe.
Wow. Can we take a breath?
Yes, we can take a breath.
I'm just, really taking in what you shared, and for people listening, and how much was in that. It's almost like digging for buried treasure, and then you find the treasure chest, and there's inside of it all of these beautiful gems. And there could be a lot of points, I think, in what you just shared that could need a pause in the episode and like, hold up a minute, I'm going to sit with that. Cause that was a distillation of, you know, not just the 35 years, but the of your practice. But I think the ancient wisdom of soul coming through the and the depth of just life journeys coming in, and even the place that even all the insight that gets stored into those trainings that we go into, it's like, oh my God, like even if I read a book, you know, I always think about a book or a podcast, it's like, wow, here we are. This is this person's life's work. And in 2 hours, I'm going to hit you with each of these things. It took me 20 years to like really refine. And so, I want to thank you for that. And I want to just send my empathy and my empathetic attunement to anybody that's listening right now. I know some of us are listening, maybe, you know, taking in these ideas conceptually and philosophically. We might not be in that charge of that experience, but we never know where we're meeting someone. And, you know, and so if you are listening right now and you're nurturing a tender heart, you know, just to let these wash over you, these insights and tools wash over you at a pace that is medicinal for your being, and know that you can press pause, come back, go deeper. And that said, I'd love to go back through a little bit with like a fine tooth comb. I was keeping some notes. Just to make sure. So did I understand correctly that forgiveness was sort of that like cauterizing completeness part at the end there, in the nonlinear end? Am I getting that right? Do you feel complete in your share?
We hit all the things.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. I mean, first and foremost, from putting ourselves into the context of being inside the container of a relationship and feeling essentially the tender bruises get pushed on and then the patterns emerge, and having the capacity to communicate with our partners what's coming up for us in a way that supports their ability to hear us and to do that part skillfully. It feels like so often what I've seen in my personal life, but also in work with people, is the identification with the emotional reaction. And so one of the things that I've noticed that's been really helpful is the question of how would this situation look sans blame and shame? If you were to just, the way you talked about the forensic element of it. So even if something is hurting you, or a need isn't being met, or there's a request that we need to make, the idea of like, even as you were saying, getting to that layer of taking responsibility, that next layer, so often it's like, it's hard for us to parse out. It's almost like it goes from, well, it's all your fault, to, oh my God, now it's all my fault. And those look like opposites, but they're really not. They're just like different arrows, like different ends of the same arrow, one pointing out and one pointing in.
Yes, and it's easy to get stuck in those polarities, so easy. And the self one, I'm so glad you brought that up, that place of landing it in, it's my fault. What did I do wrong? Is something wrong with me? Often people end relationships, or if they're struggling and they're repeating relationships or relationship patterns, they will get stuck in that polarity of, oh, it's my fault. What's wrong with me? What am I going to do next? Nobody's going to love me. It's my fault. totally. And neither of those is true. Both are in that illusion of blame. And, you know, if I had one dream for the world, it would be that we could all see through immediately the illusion of blame and be able to work back to our own heart. That's freedom. That's the beginning of intense freedom.
You know, when you said, could we see that it's just heart that is hurting, right? Like that, it's like, oh, yeah. And I've learned along the way, not in an ever after, I love that you shared that, that there's this beautiful sense of like, behind every big behavior, whether that's an acted out or a shutting down, when the behavior feels proportionately large, or in some cases disproportionately large to a circumstance that is fairly a subjective discernment, but behind those big behaviors is most often a little person. And if we can see, oh, wow, I'm meeting the four-year-old of my beloved right now, and instead of getting so fixated on the point that I miss the person, can I not take it personally? Can I, in my relationship, we talk about like Teflonning ourselves, and like, or like in the Gita with like the lotus coming up out of the water, but not getting wet because it is beating off of its petals. It's being true to its nature. But I think because our wounds are so relational, it's like they're triggered and they're reactive. But if we could slow that down, which is largely a somatic practice and not a conditional one, give a conceptual one. I'd love to get into a little bit about what you talked about with the brain, and then, you know, looking at things like brain spotting, EMDR, breath, etc., to like pattern disrupt between the recognition and the replacement levels. That I think is such a powerful recognition that the hysterical is often historical. And this is, and so don't take it personal. This is actually beautiful that this is coming up. And now it's not just like, how can I be unaffected by this reaction, but how can I lean into it and go, wow, this is so awesome that this is showing itself here. And maybe there's a possibility to move through those layers like deaths and rebirths, even within the container of the relationship. And then when we see that, wow, we can do that, we have the capacity. I felt like running. I felt like bolting. I felt like yelling. I felt like blaming. But instead of doing it or even not doing it, we just get to say, I feel like yelling, or I'm going to go yell over here. This part of me wants to blame you, or like we were talking about before, my ego wants to do. We get to say what we want to do. It's like, how can I give voice to the pattern without giving the pattern my voice? That's like the, like, to me, like the, this like beautiful nuance, at least in a way that's not damaging. Of course, like you said, we might need to burn off the externality of just like, ah, but it doesn't mean I need to get in your face and yell at you. Yeah. We can go to the supportive spaces that are the conducive to that. And so I love the affirming of the humanness in your approach. So I want to just acknowledge that in that first layer of how we communicate with our partner, sometimes because it's difficult, the work is like call in support. You know, this is where it's like, you know, I mean, that like, and so that you can sit with a therapist and be guided in an imago dialogue, like I'm going to put the bumpers in the gutters of the bowling alley, so when it goes off, just to redirect it back to the kids.
That's well put. Yeah, that's very much what it feels like in that dyad experience. It's really powerful. But I love what you said about so many things that you described. A trigger really well is that a reaction to something is greater than the situation necessitates. Such a great way to look at it, that we know it's a trigger. It's like we're blowing up. It's the landmine that goes. And then understanding when the landmine goes, we can be in self-observation, hopefully train in that skill of self-observation when our physiology begins to escalate, and then give a weather report. It's what I like to, when I work with clients, I give them these fear fighting rules. And they were given to me years ago when I was doing work on my own relationship, and I've refined them and changed them. And I was working with clients. And so we were talking, and I was just teaching, you know how this goes. And I said, you know, when you're in this, just give a weather report. It just kind of popped into my head, and it stuck, that weather report of, I'm so mad at you right now, I just want to yell. I can say that, but I don't have to do it, that I can be in observation and go, I feel like throwing something right now, but not doing it. And just giving the weather report and then taking a time out. Like, there's some simple steps to de-escalating with people. Give a weather report, take a time out, walk away, and then tell your partner when you're coming back. You know, like, I'll be back in 20 minutes, 20 minutes to get the physiology down. For most of us, it's longer than even 20 minutes, but it takes a minimum of 20 to really get your nervous system back where you can be, you know, fully co-regulated with your partner and have a good dialogue where you're like, okay, we're out of this projection and we're out of the triggering. We can talk. But those simple things, you give a weather report, you take a break when you need to, but you announce, when will we revisit? And now if there's anyone who's worked with me, they're probably laughing right now because I hammer this as best I can. It is incredibly important to ask your partner, tell your partner, when are we going to revisit this, or we will revisit this at this time. And to make that commitment, because if you don't, then the garbage collects. And now you've got a real problem. It will continually collect and it will be filled with unresolved experiences from the little ones to the large ones. And then it looms and then the triggering happens and they repeat. And so that simple idea of, you know, giving a weather report, taking a break, saying, you know what, I'm so mad, I can't even talk to you right now. I just need a break. I'm going to go for a walk. I'll be back in a half hour. Instead of, you know, you eliminate some of the behaviors and these rules for fighting, which I think are crucial, rules for boundaries for relationship. You know, people plan all kinds of things. They plan financial plan. They plan, you know, their work. Where do they want to live in the future? 5-year plan, plan with children. If you ask them, do you have a plan for fighting? I look like I have 3 heads. What are you talking about? Well, I guarantee you, you will fight in your relationship. So I would suggest strongly that you have some boundaries and rules about that. And it changes everything because you can figure out in a short period, the style of fighting and the style of disagreement that you have. And, you know, even in leaving relationships, you're going to have a relationship if this is your husband or wife and you have children. If the relationship ends, it's still important to have these skills. And it's still important to have these skills with all across the board. It's relational, that idea of, can I look back and go, ooh, how did I handle that? Did I come from my highest self? Did I handle this as my adult? Or was I in that inner child? Was I in that inner teenager rebelling? Did this person represent an authority that I didn't want to hear from? Addressing it. And sometimes we can with other people, depending on the depth of our relationship. And other times we must do it individually. And as in breakups, we often, if it is a rupture that is severe and we need proximity and there's no chance of actually having a communication with the other person that's on a level that is healthy, then we must complete these things on our own. And that can still be done with those implementing those same rules, even if the other person doesn't have the same set, because simply that's to have new boundaries, new communication. You know, there may be, you're talking about who's going to pick up who and where the children going to live and what's the parenting style. And there's a new parent coming in, and that will require for many moons, communication, and you want that to have some intense boundaries because you're passing this on to your children. What you teach them is what they see and what they live every day. And it's crucial to have these simple, they rest in empathy. It's a bed of empathy that they are built on. How does this keep it safe for us to have a relationship? How is it safe for us to have all of ourselves present, even the parts that are really uncomfortable and ugly? Can my love and empathy and commitment hold all of it? And sometimes it doesn't. Well, can this friendship hold it? Well, if it can't and you have a relationship with someone who's an ex and you're having to keep communication, then it's your job. Hold those boundaries and get to empathy for your own physical health, mental health, emotional health, spiritual health. How can I be the thing I want? Because if I'm the only one that can generate it, then it's on me. And it just becomes...
You know, that recognition that it does exist between me and me. And I don't want to necessarily tie my boat to that ship. And every time it fluctuates, I'm fluctuating with it when I have the ability to drop anchor here and be in connection with the truth of my own being. Otherwise, I'm still in the same patterns of that dynamic. And it's like you can go through the external separation, but if you're internally mirroring those same patterns, like we get to do that healing. We're only half do we get to do that work for ourselves. And I think in so many ways, that is the healing that can be offered to us, is where those little parts of us that ended up outsourcing those, whether it's security, worth, wholeness to another human, that, or to the relationship itself, like what is my relationship to relation, like the archetype of relationship that I get to now turn back towards that little me and say, I got you, and repair that work. And for those parts to feel safe in the presence of present moment us, unburdens them from those responsibilities and those tendencies. And there's that felt sense of safety internally. And then it feels like our capacity window expands enough to extend empathy, even simultaneously when there might be anger present, like you were saying, not so that I can, but while I am, that my experience can widen enough around my nervous system experience, my physiological experience, their physiological experience, all of it, see the big picture, be in relationship to ground, because that's my practice. And I get to do that for me. What an incredible honor that is. And I think then we plant that into the space, and at least it contributes. It's a contributive presence in the dynamic in some way. And yeah, so great. This, I want to go back though to the heated moment and the, I'm going to take at least 20. In my relationship, we call it like, are we rubber banding or are we taffying? Like 20 minutes might be a rubber band version,
yes.
But I need like a day might be a taffier, and we could be different, right? Like one person could be like, they're a quick integrator. They know how to regulate their nervous system, and someone else doesn't self-regulate as well. And so you've got one rubber bander and you've got one slow taffier coming back, and how to make that dance work, finding out the tools that do work for you. If you could offer people at least a few breadcrumbs to begin their work of sourcing self-regulation tools in moments of upset.
So such a great lead in there for so many things that I say that to couples. I teach that often after I observe them fighting and they report how they interact and communicate, to when they're calm, discuss how well they rebound or respond after, how quickly or how slowly. And often that one realization opens up the door to empathy. They start realizing, oh my gosh, I've been chasing my partner around the house to finish an argument and they're not ready and making it worse. But essentially, we're just naturally two different beings who process at different speeds. And doing that as part of creating fair fighting rules early on and saying, okay, these are our rules. Since you're a slow processor, why don't we give this a shot and say, we'll do this in the next day, or we'll do this in 5 hours. You can craft these rules that fit your tendencies and the anatomy of how you interact and fight. And it's incredibly healing, and it makes things more simple when you have these rules in place, because there's no longer thinking. It just becomes, this is what we do. Like you said, in my relationship, this is what we do, because you created this dynamic of, hey, this is the foundation of how we're going to fight and how we're going to figure it out. And we've got it all set up. So when we go into the ring, you know, nobody hits below the belt, and we're not bare knuckle street fighting with each other. We're really respecting how we both need to process. We're going to spar. There's no doubt about it, but we're not going to do any damage. And so doing that early in the relationship, figuring out is important. Also figuring out tolerance levels for some of our reactions. You know, there's a type of anger that some people possess where they just blow up. And after they blow up, they come right down. And so in human design, they call this a tribal wave. And so they blow up, and then they're okay. And if your partner happens to be somebody who is the opposite of that, and they are a slow go and then a slow to come down, it's going to be really difficult and uncomfortable in these arguments that the person who's slow to anger may have a difficulty with the tolerance of that kind of onslaught of anger. And that's going to take a whole practice of depersonalization. And also, one partner may have had abuse or have a high sensitivity, just be very sensitive. And each time the person blows up, it really causes a piece of damage there that they need to learn how to navigate through and also heal. And so really figuring these things out is very important. And so when the break occurs, you go, time out, you know, this is a simple one. Everyone knows this. Universal break, like adopt it. It's really simple. Time out. If you feel damage coming or you feel it coming out of you, it's, you know, it could be this, whatever it is, just, you know, I'm out. Anything you need to do to inject from that fight or flight place where, you know, all hell breaks loose. But in the break, that's when it's time to feel the feeling for yourself. Release. It's the same exact series of things we discussed previously when we're talking about people breaking up. The first is getting through that layer of uncomfortable feeling. The second is by reclaiming yourself by stepping out of the victim. You did this to me. The third is finding your pattern. What part of this is me? Oh my gosh. You know, when you say this to me, it makes me think I don't matter. And I have this such deep feeling of sadness. And so, when my person does this particular thing, I feel like I don't matter. When you don't call me on the way home, I get so angry because it makes me think you don't care. And under that is this, I don't matter. And maybe for the other partner, like, well, gosh, when you're telling me call you all the time, I feel like no matter what I do, it's not enough. It's just not enough. I call and I do this and then you miss the text and now it's my fault. So no matter what I do, it's not enough. And so the simple, everyone's missed the boat, that wasn't what was happening, right? It happened, but it was all this reactionary material that created angst. And so it's the same formula, really. It's the same place of turning. The first externalization must be released. When you take the break, you can go gnashing of teeth or writing release letters or calling a friend, that you are venting, which means you are letting out and releasing the results of a trigger. That try not to fully buy into your own baloney, for to stay away from the different word. Try not to buy into your own story and get self-righteous, but move through it down to the underlying feeling. Clear the deck and then reclaim your own responsibility and empower yourself in this place to go deeper and come back to your partner with your vulnerability. I was really angry and I was yelling before because I had this deep feeling of sadness. And the truth is, I miss you when you don't come home. It's been so many nights and I just want to spend time with you. And I feel sad when you don't call me because I just want to see you. That is a way different perspective. And even the other person, take the break, go through it. You know, I'm just exhausted lately and I want to do everything right. I'm just constantly fighting for this, wanting to do it right. And then when you called, it just triggered the thing I was already in. And it's frustrating. I don't know what to do about it. You know, I might forget to call you. You have to figure this out. But it's a different place of existing. It's one of vulnerability and saying, hey, I'm going to let you in, and vice versa. So you better make sure for both people that when you come in vulnerability, that you are both through that first phase and you're co-regulated, that you don't come in with a sneak attack with someone's open heart and then hit them. Because those
call
are
the that weapons in the wound.
Yeah. Yes. You're re-traumatizing, re-wounding, being very aware that, and if you come into contamination, which is a term that I love from encounter work, you know, encounter work, you really give a haircut to what people are saying when they have that dyad experience, really cutting it down and teaching people in those places of deep connection when their contamination comes in and being able to recognize right now, you know, this is contamination. I'm going to say something judgmental or critical, or, you know, the four horsemen of the apocalypse from Gottman, you know, this criticism, defensiveness, stonewalling. And it's the last one. I always forget the last one. But these ways of going, hey, I'm doing damage to you right now, but knowing, you know what, we have to take a break. I'm getting triggered, or, you know, you say something and realize, you know, if there's contamination, that means I got to pull out of, and I'm not going to contaminate it with my defensiveness. That is a skill. That is an incredible skill. But, you know, as we talk about this in relationship to ending relationships or creating new relationships from the pain, you know, it's clear as we speak, really, it's all the same thing. It's all the same thing. It's all the same formula of coming out of external projection and the story of who that ego, our big, you know, our ego mind wants to be, and breaking down into the realness of what our struggles are and the facade we create to protect ourselves from feeling more pain. You know, it saved us early on, and it was essential to survive, for a small psyche to survive without that mature analytical mind to protect and make right choices. But as we get older, when it occurs and it comes out, that's when we go back to either being damaged or damaging, and knowing the difference, really knowing the difference between those ego states. Am I in that adult self and being clear and open, still attached to my humanness and my heart? Or am I fully in my child where I'm still hanging on to a little bit of something and I want to get you?
So, yeah, it's really something, because it's entrained to be a protector. So it's like as if we are advocating, and so it feels like, hey, I'm doing this, I'm standing up for myself, I'm, you know, whatever the version of the projection might be. And to learn that, like, this is not that I'm in a new experience now. And then to go to that piece of where, like, it air quotes no longer serves us, but that what you just said is the part that we often miss, which is like, it did. And when we say, like, okay, I just have to get rid of this, we're doubling down. We're further compounding on the idea of you're doing it wrong, and to ourselves. And so it's like we withdraw it from that other person, we put it upon ourselves, and to be able to say, you know what, this used to serve me, and thank you for a young nervous system that didn't have the capacity to process these things. That's how we got through. And thank you for that. And now I can take you from the driver's seat and put you in the passenger seat. You know, sometimes I'll even like buckle the seatbelt of the passenger seat in to be like, you can come with me, but I'm driving. And I'll let you see, you'll have a nice clear glance of through the windshield of this life. And it feels like, you know, it can, when we take this responsibility, that it's almost as if we are co-signing on our own unlovability. And then so we're like, well, yeah, if I can empathize and validate, and even before empathy, if I can like validate what you're saying, it somehow confirms my unlovability. But when we can move through that, even like one time, you know, if I can validate and empathize one time and realize that it didn't make me unlovable, it deepened our love. It feels like that right there starts to lay down that new neuroplasticity for my brain and body to have a different physiological outpicturing that goes, oh, well, it is safe to say, hey, thank you for sharing that with me. I hear that it pushed on something for you, and I'm totally available to find another way to do that works for both of us. It's just be like, wow, that would have taken like 30 seconds, but it takes so long to get there. And I think part of it, I want to harken back to one other thing you said that really touched me, was the guy, or when I saw this guy, but the partner chasing the other person around the house. And it's like, when we're in this proximity to one another, we often conflate accessibility with availability. And I think one of the tools, especially when we're proximal to our partners, that we can ask for that, so we avoid the weaponization of the wound, the contamination, to say, I feel ready to come back to the conversation. I want to make sure you are too. Are you in a space that's available to receive me, because I'm feeling sensitive? And then if not, that's okay. And like you said, here's the time, let's try again here. So no one's left in the re-traumatization, or we have all these like protocols. And then, so all that is just so beautiful. So I want to drive into a new context. Let's say we do all of this, right? We get to do this work, we make our way through, and we come out the other side of it, and we say, you know what, this, maybe my partner does not have the willingness, the wantingness, or the capacity to meet these needs, it's not safe for me, whether that's physical or emotional, that reciprocal emotional maturity isn't available in this space, and there's not a desire to develop it. And I think I need to leave. And there is a space you talked about earlier about like the death of the dream, and like that almost like reverse engineering of the coming into connection, and then what it pushes on, I think, with like attachment wounds to primary caregivers, and like how that all gets recapitulated, as you said here, that it feels like it's like the grieving for the loss of what I thought I had, and like holding that part of me through heartbreak. So I wanted to just get your thoughts on, so I decided to leave. How do I do this? What does that layer look like in, if it was to be idealized the way these sort of conflicts and rupture and repair dynamics look?
Oh, so it's such a great question. Sounds like a book title. So I decided to leave. Totally sounds like a book title, because it would be the place that, you know, the starting point for this process is that moment. So I decided to leave. And, you know, with that comes this place of responsibility and ownership and truth. And I think that much preparation needs to go into that final decision, and to have more input than just yourself, you know, because it's easy to get stuck in a pattern and then the repeated place of it just launches us out. So when we're fully clear and the idea is, okay, so I decided to leave, then it's the conversation. It starts with the conversation of sitting down and saying, you know, I've thought about this and I just can't see this relationship continuing. It's not working. It's not fulfilling to me. Or the truth of what's happening, really, again, in that forensic way, that I don't feel fulfilled. I don't feel like I'm fulfilling you. I don't feel support from this relationship with my work. I don't feel like I'm able to support you. All of the real truth of it. And if we come out with that softness, we don't know if we will get that in return. And so preparation for the onslaught, you know, prepare for the worst and see what happens. I wouldn't even say hope for the best, but just be ready to stay in innocence and arrive in innocence. Arriving in innocence, I think, is the most important part, because that intention of going in with innocence, that if you're ready to leave, then you're ready to free yourself. And that essentially means you're freeing your partner from less of you, but they may not be in agreement with you. They have not arrived yet to the fact that you're seeing that you're actually, it's going to be less of you and less for them. That's a big jump for people if they're happily complacent in their relationship and saying, well, this was fine for me. This was what I wanted, to go back to what it was. And the partner is saying, not only do I not want it to go back to where it was, but I want to go in a completely different direction. You know, and I had someone in the past say this, and I thought, what a beautiful way to say it. She said, you know, I left my marriage of 10 years and I just told him that I needed to do this part of the journey on my own. And it was, she was so clear when she said it. I felt it in my bones that she had arrived and he hadn't. And so it was difficult, but it was such a beautiful statement. And I think that it was that clarity of, I need to do this part of my journey separately from you. And then trying to do the best of our ability to be present in what all of that means. Because even if we try to think it through of the logistics of living different places, of changing your finances, of moving your children, of separating your families. Those are all these analytical, intellectual pursuits of getting things done. But the real impact of doing it is something that doesn't happen until you're in it. And so being really empathetic with yourself right off the bat and having some compassion for yourself and some understanding for yourself to go, okay, we're going to suit up and do this and set up our support system for this challenge. And, you know, even the terminology that we give to ending relationships, like the breakup, the divorce, there's a hardness to it. So I think that's why that term conscious uncoupling was really welcomed, because it opened something else. Wait a second here. You know, not all of these have to be horrendous. If we are really paying attention in life and we're looking all along, sometimes we can prevent that hitting the brick wall if we start to really go more deeply into our experience with our partner. It doesn't have to be a brick wall. It can be a place of pain and struggle and sorrow, but it doesn't have to be so damaging if we're present. And that said, it doesn't make the grief of a relationship any easier, even if it's short term. You know, you talked about attachment wounds and the physiology. You tapped into that a little bit. You know, those places of survival, even if you're in a short relationship, it could be a few months with somebody. But if our intention and the idea is that, okay, at this point in my life, I'm really ready for a relationship, and we wholeheartedly go in, even these short-term relationships that end amicably provide the same opportunity of growth and can trigger. People will come in and say, you know, I wasn't with a person that long. And I say, well, this is all your 10,000 yesterdays showing up now, that this isn't just this one. This is, you know, all the pieces where you weren't done and they're coming up now. And really looking at that in all relationships that we leave, as we bring in our history of what our fears are about loss. And that's a big opening of loss. And what does loss mean? Is it loss of self? Is it loss of the person? And essentially, you know, my belief is that all grief, loss, and fear is really about loss of control and loss of life, fear, a deeper fear of death, obliteration, not being here. And it's, you know, it's on this continuum of feeling fear, that letting go of control and now starting again, connected only to yourself, which that's really the choice. We are always connected to ourselves, whether we do it well or not is another thing. But in breakup, we're forced to fully that responsibility of relationship to self. And, you know, this can be monumental in so many ways, but that conversation and the working through of how do I do this, lots of patience required, and you triple up on the support, practice it with someone, really think about rehearsing it and knowing that I'm honoring this relationship, even if it was terrible. It's still, you didn't start with terrible. You started with love. And you had said something previously about, you're talking about your inner child, the fearful part, putting him in the car next to you and saying, hey, I'll let you see, you know, I'm going to put you here. And, you know, addressing that part of us in a loving way. So we're using the love for self to heal self. And how do we use the love that we had in the relationship, even to end it with love, to end it? And how can we cultivate some of that remembrance and respect to end it in a loving way? And that's a true mastery. That is alchemy. You used that word previously, and I was so happy you did. I said, there's an alchemy to this thing, because we're, you know, transmuting this belief and idea of ego defenses in pain and transmuting them into love and forgiveness and empathy. And that is a magical place that only happens in the depths of us and can't really be explained. Something occurs within us and this softening happens. And that line between our ego-driven defenses and love dissipates. That to me is the ultimate lead to gold, the ultimate alchemy, is those moments where we can shift.
It's so beautiful what you just shared. And it's really the crux of what I wanted to tap into in this conversation is that piece right there. Because I feel like so many of our wounds are obviously relational. We're talking about relational dynamics and in the departure, the withdrawal of love, the wounds that can occur in the leaving. It's like, so I decided to leave, or so they decided to leave. Either side of that dynamic, like you said, can be so incredibly painful. It can produce, in yoga, what we call this, some scarring, right? Those deep embedded beliefs that get it put into us, not just like in our subconscious, the way they're often described, but, you know, neurobiologically, and they get like embedded. And so what I heard in what you shared and what I was so happy to hear in your share was this really sweet space of recognition. First off, that when we say taking responsibility, if we were to look at the, you know, etymologically break that down, it means the ability to respond. And it doesn't mean the reactive blame. It means the ability to respond and this sort of prophylactic, preemptive, preparative, like, let me call in my support. How do I want to have this conversation in honor of this journey that we've shared, in honor of this other human that I've shared it with, and the journey that they've been on and that they'll continue to move through. And instead of choosing to leave from the compulsive explosion on that first emotional reactive layer you described earlier, let me really make sure I do all my work. And a lot of times, you know, people will, if they do this part, they kind of leave, they do all their work inside the relationship before they leave it to make sure, hey, I've done this. I'm not just leaving as a reaction rather than able to respond, and taking that accountability in a beautiful way, and then extending this recognition of humanness and extending our hearts and empathy. Because if we've been on either side of that, that uncoupling that you're describing, I would imagine, and I think from my experiences I've really felt it both ways, Mary, where it's like, some of the greatest healing gifts I've ever experienced are the ends of relationships that disconfirm the narratives of past ends that have felt so brutal. And it's like, oh, wow, like maybe the exiting is the greatest medicine if done well. So it's not that I'm out, you're awful, I don't love you, you're not wanted. And it's like, it's just about, I'm just want to go through this part of my journey. I need to go through this part of my journey without you. And I love you. And it's like, it's oof, how reparative in the midst of a rupture itself could that be? And, or at least the perceived rupture. It's like, we're still caretaking. We're still stewards for each other. We're still in recognition of our divinity. And I think that is how we connect to the true self, because as I was saying at the beginning, it's like self is as now. And I just want to close this piece with a share of going through a breakup. I was sitting on my porch. It was like a rainy day. I was in the little screened in porch, and I was really in it, like just in that sort of entropic, like depressiveness, and feeling like it was just kind of falling and falling. And for whatever reason, my eyes caught an outlet on my back porch that there wasn't anything plugged into. And I realized I didn't feel plugged in. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. What is this about? Why? And it was so resonant to my pain. And it wasn't only not being in the receiving of the love, but the part of me that wanted to give love felt like there was another part of me that intervened and said, okay, now we're supposed to stop loving them. And I had to cut off from love. And I realized I could plug myself in. And then when I did that, I was like, oh, wait a second. That feels, first off, really good. I can continue to love. And then I heard my wisdom, thankfully, come in and say, love is your nature. You're never unplugged. And I was like, in this one moment, I was filled with so much presence and remembrance, like embodied remembrance of that. My true nature is love, and her true nature is love. And it's our nature to be in the exchange of love. And I could love her in the state that she was in her higher self, and me in the state, and me and myself in honor, and say goodbye and offer closure to this chapter. But I didn't have to ever be separate from love. In fact, I couldn't be. And like, even when we're not present to that connection, it's still present. And that, in that way, that letting go was the alchemy. This is so powerful.
So beautiful, and such a good reminder of this energy of love that we can utilize and if we do the old pattern that you mentioned of just cut and run, we miss the opportunity to do this buffet of work. We leave this meaty bone behind, and just out of fear and the idea that this is too, the pain I don't want to feel, I want to blame you and just leave. We miss this rich opportunity to feast on all these emotions and then come back to love, loving self and loving and honoring that relationship. And it's amazing the experience you have, the truth of it, the realness of embodying that feeling of, I don't have to stop loving this person, even though it may not go as I thought. I can still have love there, and that doesn't have to leave. And, you know, it's just such a richness to land in that, but it's also confusing. Now, what do I do with this? Where do we go with this? How do I feel the sadness that comes with seeing them leave or do whatever's, you know, they may move on, have another job, be with another person, and trying to tap into that and still use that to move my heart through these emotions, to flush my heart with that love and know that that's the place that you will have the softness instead of this rigidity of staying in that upper level, this surrender of letting ourselves break, just letting it break and letting that heart completely break, but knowing that it's not going to take us down. Because, you know, we talked about when you're in that idea of loss that hits the attachment wounds from childhood, that feeling can feel like a death, and it can be terrifying. And so the energy behind that is one of fighting for your life. And that's where the opposite behaviors occur. So, you know, instead of noticing our ego, I'm terrified to be alone, I'm terrified to face this, this is horrible, I don't want to. Instead of going into that and knowing that there's love on the other side, we go deeper into the ego mind of protection, and then, you know, fall into rumination or fall into this, which can become, this rumination can become a pathological need or desire to have the person back if we're left. And when people get stuck there, and I've encountered this several times, it's very painful to watch. They have a hard time coming out of this ruminative place of just recapitulating the story and in pursuit. I want them back. I just want it back. I want it back. Deep place of intense loss that feels like fight for my life to fill this and have this, or I can't survive. Because, as you know, when we were infants, our caregivers were our lives. So that food, water, everything we needed, they were our gods. And so this idea of losing that connection, a very life force attached to a person, can be terrifying. And it makes it come from that instead of saying, oh, I'm crazy. What's wrong with me? What is wrong? Why can't I stop thinking about this? Why can't I stop? And even judging our partner, they're insane. They keep wanting me back. And I've told them over and over, instead of really seeing the clarity of pain in that brokenheartedness and the terror that's being triggered from that history, that little self that is just saying, I don't know what's happening and I can't tolerate. It's taking me to a place of intense fear, and turning it that way. But those behaviors that seem so erratic are always spurred by fear.
So yes, we're like right in the current right now. Like, I can feel it in this conversation. And again, just being like so sensitive to, if someone's in this right now, like, I offer my heart and empathy. I know this feeling. You know, I know this feeling. And so I would love to offer, to the degree of availability, that what you might, what you've seen in your work that is helpful for people that are stuck in that ruminative pattern.
So being stuck there does feel like a pathology. It starts to feel like an addiction. And interestingly, there is a response from your physiology that feeds this. So even when you're looking for a solace, some kind of relief, and even in the searching, it starts to feel like, if at least I'm searching, I'm not sitting in the pain. And so, you know, the ego tells us the opposite. It says, go this way for protection, go deeper into a removal from this tenderness in you so you can be safe, go find, get them back so you're okay. And that's not the way to go. It's reminding ourselves that, wait a second, my ego is searching, my mind is searching for some pain relief. I need to come back to myself. I need to go back in. And so if it turns into this rumination all day, that's when I tell people, if you can inject some friends, if you can action in ways, is get support, have someone work with you. And if those ways of thinking become obsessive, and I look back through relationship and find that, yes, they actually are addicted to people, or they're addicted to sex, or they're addicted, I will suggest some form of recovery. Sex and love addiction is a 12-step form of recovery. I'm not always a huge fan of 12-step, but what I am a fan of is the community it creates and the internal focus that it provides. And I've seen people heal tremendously with that program in situations like this, knowing they just left a relationship and they're in this place in their mind that they can't get out of. And that's when the realization sets in that, wait a second, there's more going on here than the loss of this relationship. This was an addiction. And I'm using this love and possibly sex as a way to feed some emptiness in me that needs to be addressed. And so super important to really tap into that. And if you are in that kind of thinking and it goes on for any period of time, that's when you need some support, some real support to go directly into therapy, go directly into a program like SLA. Because getting out of it can be incredibly difficult if you think about any addiction, and it can take over for long periods of time, months, years, this back of the mind thinking and trying to live through life with this addictive thinking leading the way. And then often people will just wash, rinse, repeat and find another person to put in that place to become addicted to abandon self and abandon their own pain. And jump onto someone else's life in order to just survive. And that's really difficult. It's disempowering to self-abandon. And we create the same thing with that self-abandonment, that someone else to blame, someone else to focus on, a place to jump off of our own power for whatever reasons, leaving ourselves because our own pain is too great and trying to attach to somebody. And then it's easy to find someone who says, great, I want to reach to you that, and I can lift you up and I can make you better. So I can also self-abandon, but I can look a little better than you. So I can blame you because you are admittedly the one with more pain, or clearly our dynamic shows that I'm not codependent or I'm not the problem, but we draw the same level of enmeshment, codependence, individuation that we exhibit. It's the perfect match. We will find somebody who is going to reflect our abilities very clearly.
Yeah, what a match, right? I mean, there's a co in codependence. It's like you play that role. It's really beautiful, the call for support, because that's the opposite of self-abandoning. Yes. And it shows that there's a seed of turning towards self. And I think this is where we really get into the core of the work I don't know in terms of the psychologist training, but like in terms of like the shamanic and the spiritual integration and the yoga and the plant medicine and these tools that are really decidedly about the reclamation of self, capital S, and that all of these addictions, right, substance process, et cetera, like are somehow a leaving and abandoning of self. And whether we patchwork that together with the next relationship and we just jump into it, or we're in some sort of enforced solitude where we're not relational anymore, the different, behind this door and behind that door, it can feel, especially when the physiology is heightened and we're whether hyper or hypo, it's like when we're not regulated to self, it's like that's the core deviation, the core wound. And, in yoga teachings, we call that avidya, not being in connection with one's true essence. And then if as we follow that through the line, we end up in this deep clinging abhinivesha to bodily life and the identity we construct within it. And then this cycle is repeated lifetimes, so it's like it's some scars that reincarnate. And so it's like we're called to this path to come home and to our true nature. And oftentimes it's like, these are the experiences that have the seed of potential to catalyze that, you know, that beautiful pilgrimage back to our true nature. And if we can hold it as such and find community of people that are going through it, I agree with you so much. There's something about that reflective that, oh, I thought this was just me going through this. And part of my hope in having this episode is to universalize these feelings and give people something they can listen to. It could be 3 years from now and go, oh, okay, these are like universal, normal human processes. And this is how I can navigate them. And so I wanted to home in on that navigation piece, because we can be so identified with these energies, especially when the prefrontal is going offline and the amygdala is flaming and we're in that identification. What are some specific tools that one could utilize in their own sovereignty outside of, say, a therapeutic setting to practice discernment between conditioned response that tends to compel reactive patterning and truth? So some inner guidance, a trustable inner guidance mechanism. And then what are some that you use inside of therapeutic setting to help bring people back to, you know, being online and build capacity to discern?
Yeah. So that's always the toughest place, is when we're in reaction and trying to hang on to ourselves. So I know that you're going to have a lot of meditators watching this. And really what I've found in every practice that I do, every tool that I share, everything just rests in awareness. And so the beginning is being very present and in your body, and mindfulness practice. You know, there's a difference between mindfulness meditation and other meditations. There's many kinds of meditation, but particular brand of mindfulness that's the original, you know, was taught as MBSR, is really coming into presencing, being fully embodied in your experience. And the practice of mindfulness, you know, not to bash any other types of meditation, I think all meditation is good meditation, but this particular brand of meditation, this particular type of meditation, lends itself to change. So when people enter the therapeutic process, I will often push them toward mindfulness and, you know, MBSR in particular, because it is research based and they are trained very specifically to use certain words to say certain things that keep people internal. And it works. It's been proven to work. I mean, it wouldn't be in 800 hospitals in the country if it didn't work. And so it's an introduction, and people from all walks of life, and if they're very spiritual, if they're not spiritual at all, it will work. And so it's sometimes even a beginning for people to say, I would never think of meditating. I would never do that. And I said, okay, well, let's do this for your therapy, for your practice. And you often find that they begin to shift in these simple practices that they happen in day-to-day life, like off your mat. You know, you're sitting, but outside of sitting, you're living. And in your living, you're taking that with you in each moment. And we forget. We may forget for an hour. We may forget for 3 days. We may forget for a week. But the moment we come back, we realize, wow, wait a second, I haven't been here. And so strengthening that ability to be fully present and even understanding what that means, what it actually means to be present and not miss the things we used to miss. And so when we cultivate that ability to be present, when we're in these moments that are uncomfortable, if we become sensitive, we are keenly aware that we are in observation of our emotions. We are not our emotions. They're a thing that occurs, and they're a navigation system for us to learn. They're the signs of, like, hey, lessons are coming. And so when we can cultivate mindfulness, that's the first step of saying, now I have a choice. You know, Brené Brown did this talk, and she has so many. I wish I could tell you what the exact talk was, but she put this formula up, and I had a dear friend make a sweatshirt of this formula. And it's basically the letter S with a set of brackets in between and the letter R, stimulus, pause, response. The magic is in the pause. When we can cultivate our ability to implement that pause is our doorway to freedom. And so that practice, as simple as it may seem, or like a blunt instrument, but it is not. It is a surgical tool to bring ourselves down. In that moment, we can now put in some 10 connected breaths where we sit breathing deeply and slowly several times to just get our physiology to shift. We may have that moment to say, I need to go outside and put my feet on the ground and be outside in the air. I need to just have some space to come back down. We may be able to, if we're very in a panic, we're going to take some ice and put it on the back of our neck to bring down physiology quickly, to take cold water, even putting your face in very cold water to shift the physiology. Shaking when there's a lot of stress, just shaking, movement, things that will shift the physiology, activating serotonin and dopamine. You know, sometimes if we need the time, like we had said, break for a moment from the argument, can you go do body work? Can you go sit in the sauna? Can you go meditate for a few minutes? What ways can we outgas this stress that we're feeling and get back into a regulated state and then eventually be able to regulate with our partner? But, you know, it's important to have a few practices, breath, that people learn, inhaling to the count of four, holding to the count of four, exhaling to four, holding to four, repeating the cycle. Just this, if you even observe what that simple practice does, is you're counting. So you're going from your hindbrain into your frontal lobe. So activating the frontal lobe by counting, you're presencing because you're controlling your breathing, and then the benefits of the breath itself by super oxygenating. And so all of these things is I'm focusing on something. You know, when you're super, super triggered, one of the best things to do is to read for 20 minutes because you're coming offline and now you're not even ruminating about what happened. You're actually doing a track jump. From I'm going to go from here. Let me just focus on something that I can engage my frontal lobes that were previously offline and then direct them towards something that I can just pull myself off and then come back when you are like, okay, now I've come down because I've done something with my own brain that takes me out of that hind brain. We can't read very well or process information. We're not using that part of the brain. But the way to do that is go and read for 20 minutes. Take that time to just engage in an activity that brings you present until you're more balanced and ready to come back and do a deeper piece of work. So, you know, it's important to have that a little arsenal of things. And really, people get comfortable with the things that work for them. And it's trying on each of those and finding. I've had many people in my practice, and I'm sure you've had many people come to you who say, I just can't meditate. I don't like it. I don't want to. Resistant. There's many other things. That's fine.
This is great. And this is a great conversation. I'm really enjoying this right now. And I think it's really valuable. And so a couple of things that show up for me, and then I want to get to yours in context of therapeutic setting practices that you find helpful, things like EMDR, brain spotting, the role of plant medicine, ceremony, et cetera. But to speak briefly to this idea of meditation, especially not only as the pattern disruption practice, like when we're in the trigger or in that arc of the trigger, but in the moments when we're not, to cultivate the expanded capacity for presence. It's like we can meditate for when we're not meditating is what I heard you say and what I can confirm from subjective experience, just again, subjective only. But that when I meditate during especially in the morning, that I have a greater availability of presence for the things that would typically activate me to now have that witness conscious availability to essentially shift emotion from subject identification to object identification. And now I'm able to look at it and my emotion isn't telling me who I am, it's telling me how I am, and I can receive it as an indicator signal on the dash while we're driving said car with little Scott in the passenger seat and able to go, hey, let's look at what is this flaring up from? What got activated? I'm listening. Is there something that you didn't get to say then that you can say now? Is there something you didn't hear then that I can offer you that you could hear now? How can I meet that need now? Is there something you needed to happen then that hasn't happened now? How can how can I be with you and take care of you? But it's meditation that provides that capaciousness to be able to go, oh, okay, now I'm here. And it's not this non-attachment of like, yes, sort of like this closed offness. It's actually much greater availability to be present with what is in context to what I am. And now I know how to hold it. And even so, all this personality, ego, it's not like, as I hold it, not to be tossed, but to be integrated. Mm-hmm. And when we can experience it within the wholeness of who we are, that's yoking. That's the yoga. That's the inner child. Where it's all pointing to the same, let come back to self. And so I think that's really beautiful to have practices for when we're not triggered as well. So they are built into our circuitry for when we need them. In the same way that, like, you know, the trauma gets stored or vaulted, so does our healing. In the same way that trauma is generational, healing is too. And so for the generations, whether it's within this life, our soul legacy, or our broad, like, you know, soul collective legacy, it's really beautiful to contribute this sense of mindfulness of our emotional states. And so I love that that's where you went with it and wanted to share my own experience. And also just to briefly say, for those of us that have sat down to meditate and said, I can't meditate, I feel like, so, I don't know about your journey with this, Mary, but mine has been, sometimes there's been a misinterpretation maybe between stimulus and response of like receiving, how we received an instruction, that it was supposed to be about stopping the mind. Like, it was never about stopping the mind. And I think sometimes this is largely goes back to a misinterpretation in the core texts by the teachers of the Yoga Sutras, talking about something like yogas chitta vritti nirodha, that they'll say yoga is the cessation of the fluctuations of the mind. And so then they go, okay, well, I'm supposed to stop the fluctuations of my mind. I'm supposed to not be thinking. And then they go take a yoga class, and the teacher says, well, come to a quiet mind. Okay, cool. Where's the fucking switch? Like, we don't just get to stop our mind. That's the mind's nature to think. Yes. But when I can allow it its nature, and while I'm observing it, it allows me mine. And from that standpoint, it's a very different experience, rather than that I'm going to intrude and meddle and try to control and get rid of this thought, keep that one aligned, instead of opening this expanded context of witness. And to whatever arises, this too is my practice. And from that seat of noticing, I begin to establish a seated self. Yes. Is that how you hold it? You hold it different?
Yeah. No, it was well put. I really like the way you put that. And when people have trouble meditating, sometimes I'll give them, you know, in vivo life practices to become aware of self, because you described so well, so perfectly, self-observation and strengthening ability to watch the fluctuations of the mind, to be aware, like, oh, this is my mind. This is me watching my mind and strengthening that space between, because it's in that space between that we may be privy to quiet mind for a moment, but this ability to sit in the seat of ourselves in each moment. And, you know, when people resist, I will often implement in life ways. I had a gentleman recently who was fighting, you know, oh, I don't like it, I didn't do it. So I gave him a little exercise about, I just want you to be aware of when you're walking, feel your feet and be aware of, and just notice really when you're doing something like with the tactile, you may be driving, if you're driving or walking. And he said, well, I take the subway. So he had the experience on the subway that he stepped into the subway and he said, all of a sudden I realized, oh, I'm supposed to be aware on the subway. And so he started looking around and he goes, you know, and I realized I don't look at people on the subway. You know, I'm in New York. I don't do this. And he had this amazing experience of the subway that he rides every day, but he wasn't in the subway every day. He was in his mind. And so he came out of it and it really shifted him. And then I said, okay, I want you to brush your teeth mindfully. I want you to do this practice. And he said, you know, it was kind of weird at first. I'm like feeling my toothbrush and I'm doing all these sensate things. And he said, but I got it. He goes, I really understand. He said, I've noticed now how much I'm not in my life. I said, okay, this is the beginning. So even in those practices, he was beginning to tap in. I'm still working on the meditation with him, but it's progress. That awareness, that embodiment, the presencing.
And I think it's so important that it's not obligated. It is of our own agency to turn towards it. And it's funny how it'll turn from like, I'm supposed to, or I have to, I think it's an enacting of a discipline to become this devotional, like I crave it. And when I do it now, it's not like, I think part of why it works, maybe deeper than the, I don't know the research side of the MBSR piece, but having meditated for 25 years as a practice, I will say, like, again, subjectively speaking, that it feels like I call it the ritual of returning. It's like a communing with my own self. And some days it's a mess, and some days it's quiet, and some moments it's a mess, and some moments it's quiet, even within the container of one sitting. And it's almost like the result is none of my business. I just turn towards it as an art of turning towards me. And there's something inherent in the act itself that feels like it's the opposite current of when we were describing the addiction as like a turning away from self. And it's as if I'm saying, without saying it, whatever version shows up today, I'm with you. And then that piece of like compassionate self-witnessing. And so it's not just observing or witnessing in this sort of sterile analytical sense. It's like heart witnessing.
I love the way you put that turning toward and the acceptance that it's an inference of I accept where I am as I sit with myself. Just sitting with myself. And I love what you said about meditation, that it's not a discipline. It's more like food. Once it hits, it's like, oh, I need to meditate. It's like, I need food. It just, there's a fulfillment that comes with sitting deeply with self. That like, oh, I'm just going to go home for a minute. I'm just going to stop at home. I can do it anywhere.
It's so beautiful. Yeah, it's amazing. So if we could then bring it to what you lean on in a therapeutic sense, if we were in, if you were working with somebody in, let's say they're in the heartbreak of the after of their relationship and really needing some support. I know there's something inherent in what we just described of this compassionate self-witnessing, especially by another, that is just like, I'm just with you in your pain, like that alone, like I'm just going to your office, I'm sitting on your couch, like that is like, that's something. But what are the specific modalities that work, that have shown themselves to be beneficial, and why do you think that they work?
So I'll give you the first one that I give to people, and for many, many things, and it's something I received on a journey myself. Very simple, very clear exercise to put your hand on your heart, your hand on your navel, and closing your eyes, sitting, getting quiet, and just asking, what do I need? What do I need? And what do I need mentally? What do I need physically? What do I need spiritually? What do I need emotionally? Not what do I have to do, but what do I really need? And sometimes it's like, I just need space. I just need a hug. I need people. I need to feed myself. I need more rest. But what do I really need? And often that can be last on our list in any one of those four places that sometimes our physical needs. Oh, I'm busy today. I can't really eat as I would like. Oh, I'm emotionally, well, I have other things to do. I don't have time for that. I have to handle my mental things or my world life. Or, well, spiritually, I'll meditate at the end of the day. I'll talk to God tomorrow. You know, this idea of really placing what you truly need right in front of you first. And that creates your own navigation system that essentially leads healing and heartbreak navigation system through these steps to releasing the anger first and coming back to out of the victim and taking responsibility and then you know, going further into the patterns. But the beginning is you lead. And it works because if I lead outside of creating this framework for someone, if I lead to me by your side or even behind you as you lead, and I just kind of remind you in the best way I can. And, you know, when somebody's very lost, we go back to structure. So these are the things we need to do. These are the places you need to explore emotionally. But essentially, that guidance of what do I need is the first answer. That's your own intuition. And no one can doubt what you say you need. I can fight your experience and hold that to the best of my ability and just guide you in ways that many ways you already know, but we're so in pain and lost from that we cannot contact that part of us. It becomes, there's a lot of static. And so I think that's the first and best tool always for all healing. And then after that comes the person you trust the most, the person that you can count on that left you and you don't have a second, then your homework would be to find a second.
I love that. That's so good. One of the things I love teaching yoga is we start our practices with our hands on our heart, tuning into what we need. And that is it. And just to establish that line of communication between you and you, while you then go about regulating breath, self-observation, and moving your body, it's like, whoa, what an ancient practice we've inherited here. It's a really beautiful attunement. So thank you for that contribution.
I always tell people to go a little deeper than you think if you're sitting in pain. So here's why. And I really wanted to inject this because it just happened to me with someone going through a breakup who's been stuck in it for a long time. And I said, okay, tap in, sit, find this place. And I said, what do you need? Peace and love, peace and understanding. I said, okay. But that's a concept. That's further away. You know, how do we create that? That's a novel, right? That's an endless search. So let's go a little deeper. What's under that? What do you need? And in a second, this person listed very specifically all these things. I need a comfortable place to live. I need this. I need that. I need, in succession, in a very short period of time, just a few seconds. And then came out of it and I said, wow, for someone who feels really disconnected, you know what you need. So, you know, that caution, the first answer that may just come from an idealized thing of just jump me here. Because in that moment, this person's great intelligence was so effective and so accurate. And I thought, wow, I was just let into the kingdom here. And now that's the resource now. Now you've told me what you need. Now it's my job to do my best to remind you. It was super powerful and very simple. So that practice you begin with is super powerful.
I'll often describe it, interestingly enough, as we're here to pick up a little piece of what we forgot that we like already knew.
The great remembering.
Yeah. It really is a stance, I think, ultimately, forgetting and remembering. Spiritually, and subjectively here, hold this belief that like it's not our soul that forgets, that it's that inculcation of life into the heart, mind, that personality, etc., that we fall into forgetting. So there really is, in this present moment right now, if we could delve into the continuum of consciousness that does know. And so it is available and we're never severed from that. It's just like, oh, how can I regulate enough to remember and enact these practices to turn towards what is in here already? And so I like the way you present the therapeutic context as supporting people really in supporting themselves. And how empowering is that for that person to go walk away from that session and go, you know what, I do have access. And
yes,
that's so powerful.
I love what you said about like this forgetting and remembering, because I have this joke with a friend of mine. We used to chat and talk and I'd vent with her and I'd say, all right, I got this. We'd talk again and be like, I forgot this. So it became like the, I forgot this, I got this. Wait a second, I forgot it, I remember now. And I thought it's all healing is about remembering, forgetting, learning, you got this, then you forget again, then you remember again, and that the layering just keeps going. So when you said that, it just struck me as so funny that yes, it is this It's really remembering ourselves and remembering some of the things we already know. And there are always things to learn, of course. There's always things we share. We're here to walk each other home, the old saying, we're here to help each other. But that idea of, you know, forgetting and remembering, it's very much, I believe, the path, just as you said.
Yeah, it's so true. So I know we went off track a little bit there. Are there other practices? I know you utilize some different things in your work that that you find particularly powerful.
You know, as a therapist, I use, you had mentioned brain spotting and EMDR, and I've really come to love the work of brain spotting, along with breath work, which is extremely powerful. And I always tell people, well, breath work is like a grenade. It really opens things up. If people are closed, it's going to open them up. And then I find that brain spotting is like a laser. It's very specific to work with, and it's incredibly powerful. And that's a tool that can be utilized in therapy and be taught to people as a practice on their own to find places in the visual field where they had trauma and their eyes were in that position when trauma occurred. And we resource spots in the visual field in order for them to sit in a mindful way with their eyes fixed in that position, allowing the body and the memories and the experiences to all sort of coalesce and release and process through without much impedance from me as a therapist. It becomes an internal processing where people are really processing themselves once they can access these feelings and memories. It causes a great bridge to occur between unprocessed material and the frontal lobes blocked and old memories weren't able to be processed. We can now link those together in a safe, calm way that the person can access their emotions and just be very present in their frontal lobes and allow that to move through without, you know, keeping them regulated. And so they can process trauma very quickly, because if I'm not in the way, I'm not trying to tell them how to process. Our brains process through association. We'll never be able to get in someone's brain and say, hey, that thing when you were 5 is sort of like the thing when you were 13 and you were 12. And it will just occur in this process as we line the person up. It's all we have to do is line ourselves up with our emotions, our body, and using the physiology of the brain to create that catalyst for healing to just occur naturally. And I find that with a lot of practices that the more we're, you know, in brain spotting, we use the term be in the tail of the comet, allow the client to lead, because when they lead, they know the way. We just have to take some of the blinders off and then magic occurs. Then it can make the process slower, because if I think you should go a certain way, then I may be preventing you from getting there in a way that could be much faster than I could ever have known, because it's really occurring within your mind and you're kind of sharing it as much as you want to or not want to as the process unfolds. So incredibly powerful to use that technique for me. And then, of course, like you were saying, is try to equip people with their own tools, because, you know, I've loved therapy. I've done my own. I do my own. It's great. But most people want to be happy, heal, and go and live. And so the idea is to equip them with processes. And I like to do experiential work in my practice, so people have things to take with them. So if they come in for sessions and they leave with tools. They leave with things that they can utilize and continue their path. If they never see me again, they go on to someone else, but they have something with them. They have a few things, hopefully, with them that they can utilize regularly to help them along the way.
Amazing. Yeah, I really love that, because I would imagine, you know, like the temptation in the space holder seat, you know, I see that sometimes come up when you're in that recognition of the pattern and you're like, well, here I can make a constellation out of all this for you, but you deprive, that's such a stealing of the person's, you know, revelation of that and integration of it, you know, in an embodied way. And then, but to support the environmental conditions, so to speak, for the unconscious and the conscious to be in simultaneous presence with each other is faster than you, you know, blurting out the end to the story, so to speak. And it's like getting to, you know, it's just like getting to hold space for people to come home to themselves is I think the work in any format, you know, it's in the role of teaching yoga. What's so beautiful is it is a practice. And a lot of times when teachers are like initially accessing their wisdom, they sometimes can come out like in a preachy sense, like do this, like, versus transforming insights into inquiry prompts for people to have their journey, you know? And it was like, you know, when I was first learning, teaching, I was taught this idea, like, your job is to meet people where they are. And I was like, well, that sounds really beautiful. And then I started teaching and I'm in these group environments where I don't really know really where anybody is, to be honest, because they walked into a yoga class and they're sitting down to meditate. I have no idea. I can read the room. I can tune into the energy. But people can present so differently than what they're experiencing. And I had to adapt that for myself. And I share this in our teacher trainings now. And I say that our goal as teachers or space holders is not to meet people where they are. It sounds beautiful, but it's to hold a space that allows people to meet themselves where they are. And that's really what we're learning how to do. And so all of this said, we have just a few minutes, and I wanted to get into two more questions. We could do speed round. We kind of delved into this piece of like post breakup. I want to jump back in, or I want to go back to what was, or I want to jump into what's next. But I also often see the pattern of enforced isolation. I'm not ready to be in a relationship. I have to heal myself before I get into a relationship again. I wondered if you could speak to that and then just kind of thread it into, so you're ready now to actually come back into a relationship, and how do we enter in skillfully? Because what I heard earlier was that a lot of times the leaving that gets messy is actually a reflection of the entering in not being as conscious. So could we go through those two pieces?
So entering in really takes a lot of self-reflection, because it is easy early in the early stages of healing to go a month or 2 months even, and, you know, be grieving a relationship of 10 or 12 years and to want to jump into something else. And also, if there's something else in the offing, if you are the one leaving and saying, oh, there's this other shiny thing happening, it's very simple to go, well, I just feel good, so I'm going to go to the next thing. So that takes a lot of inner reflection in that particular case, because it is easy to just go from one thing to the other and say, hey, I'm good. I know I've done all my work in the relationship. That's rarely the case. There needs to be normally some time of real aloneness and that sense of rebuilding before going into the next relationship. And, you know, there's no wrong answers. If that occurs, there are lessons there as well. So that's just the learning in that case. And so in the other cases where, yes, you've taken time and said, you know, for X amount of time, maybe a year or 6 months or however much time serves, I'm not going to entertain any relationship. I'm just going to really self-reflect. And you know, when I've seen people re-enter and say, I'm ready now, you just have to tread lightly. I mean, everyone's going to get their lessons in their time, and just looking at where they really are, what the motivation is it still, well, I just don't want to be alone, or I'm afraid I'll never find somebody and I met somebody, or is it a jump off point, or is it a true place of, you know, I want to go out and experiment. And when I've worked with people and they are there, often they're terrified when they are ready. And to me, and that's just, this again is anecdotal, this is just my experience of seeing people go through this, when it's really time to re-enter, they are very hesitant to do so. And to me, that's when I say, you're ready. Sometimes they are ready and they don't want to. And I will ask them, what's happening? It seems like you may be ready. And they are in that, I don't want to do it because I'm afraid. And so that little bit of fear yet willingness is normally the point, the sweet spot of going back and creating something new, because there's a realization of, I don't know what I'm doing now because I'm not going to do what I did before. So I'm stepping into the unknown. And now whatever meaning I'm making of this relationship is going to be vastly different into other relationships.
That's amazing. Yes. Yeah, it's such a delicate art, because it's like, I don't want to, like, you know, jump right into something, right? And at the same time, this sort of enforced, like, isolation retreat for 10 years until you are ready, that hasn't worked. The idea that I have to be fully healed before entering in, to me, is a myth, because the healing is relational, or the wounding is relational. The healing is too, like, isn't the purpose of relationship in one way to provide that healing work?
Yes.
You know, and how do we do that dance?
That dance, exactly. It's so very true that, you know, we're not going to go in unaffected, and we're not going to come out unaffected. That's the risk of relationship, and the beauty of it as well, that this bittersweet of the risk to love and then thinking, you know, it might not work out. And I always tell people this story that people will say in relationships, it didn't work out. And I'll say, it did work out. It just didn't work out the way you wanted to. It had a beginning, a middle, and an end story that you had attached to it. So it definitely worked out. So now we figure out, what did you learn from it? How can you grow from it?
Yeah, it's really something I've appreciated about you over the years of knowing you, is that whatever the circumstance is presenting, it's always like, so it's like, okay, so you go back and you're like, okay, so then there was still karma there. And it's, you left and it's like, oh, so there's karma there. And it's like, I'm in between. So wherever you are, there's something, there's a reason you're there. There's something to work with. It's like, it's not about right, wrong. It's about catalyzing experience into growth.
Yes, so well said.
Is there anything left for you that feels unsaid before we end our conversation?
I think that my favorite thing to remind people of wherever they are in relationship is that empathy is the number one answer for our connection to ourselves and other people. And it's always this doorway into a deeper knowing ourselves, knowing others. But it can be the hardest thing to do. And most people think they're a good person. And so they'll come in and be maybe embarrassed about their anger or their deeper feelings because they don't match this good person. And I think the only way to get to empathy is to face good people, even though we're angry. It doesn't make us not good people to have these negative thoughts and these bad ways of thinking, or these, you know, these reactive ways. But if we want to get deeper in our acceptance of ourselves, we must accept other people and get to that level of empathy. And it's true freedom is what it brings. And so to me, in all relationships, wherever they stand, that's the secret sauce, is empathy.
I love that so much, because it's not just a mental quality, but it's heartfulness. It's like the blend of mindfulness and heartfulness.
Agreed.
I wanted to close on that note with a little poem here, and it is a little writing. Just pull it up real quick, because you kind of triggered the reminder of this piece.
Is it something you wrote?
Yes, yeah, so this is something I wrote. Say again.
I love that, because I was like, oh, I hope it's something that he wrote.
thank you. Yeah, it's, empathy is the art of adventuring into the mandala of another's indigenous realm of symbols, myths, and meanings with eyes of compassion and ears of curiosity, setting down our own parables, empty of animus towards the unresolved, in service of communion as companion.
Beautiful.
That's
beautiful.
Yeah. And that's it. And may that be the takeaway for this conversation, whether we're in it, we're leaving it, the in-between, whether the other person's available or not, may we turn towards with an open heart. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much. This was amazing. It was just wonderful to do this with you and spend time with you.
Thank you. Yeah, same. I feel the same. And for everybody that has or will be tuning in, or is tuning in right now, listening to this, you know, whenever that time comes for you, thank you for being with us on this journey of self-remembering, and a deep bow to you for the work that you're doing in your life. And we're there with you doing it too, right there alongside in the circle of our humanness. Until next time, take care, my friend.